10 seconds. Okay, I think that means that the live streaming is on, and then we can start this. It's been 149 episodes before this, so this is Extinction Naughty number 150, which is incredible, really. You know how fast this thing goes, and as I wrote in the show notes, this has been like 4 installments of this podcast or the Extinction Naughty show. And in the beginning, we had Lord Yu, the South African sailor in the Mediterranean in his catamaran, and that was sort of the start of this whole thing. He was some kind of guru, or you know, ironically calling himself the guru, and we had some sort of a cult and stuff. And I think that installment practically ended when he died on his sailboat, and then we tried to gather some of his followers to do the show without the big star in the middle, which was interesting. And then that went on for a year, maybe a year and a half, and then everybody threw me out, but they stopped having shows, so I started having shows, you know, because why not, right? So that was the third installment, and now we're back to trying to start things up again, and doing the podcast, you know, uploading the file to the podcast thing on Spotify and stuff, and so basically just trying to talk about something, and see where it goes. So that's that. Today we have Zio, a new participant from Norway, I believe.
Yes, that's right. I have been watching before, and I'm not so familiar with the concept really, so I'm not sure how much I have to talk about with you, but I just have to try, you know, and see what happens.
Yeah, I think I can say as much that this, even though this was ironically called a cult in the first installment when Lord Yu was still around, it's no longer a cult. At least I've decided it. This is not a cult. It's just some people talking with other people, and we basically take the liberty of just doing what we do, and then that becomes the thing. If you understand? So that's kind of that idea. I don't know. Have you seen any things or trends or developments in the last months or so, which you would like to, you know, raise or talk about, or what's on your mind, basically? Zio.
Well, I'm so unfamiliar with what you've been doing here in these meetings, so I'm not sure. How would you introduce it if you were to explain what kind of conversations, what kind of topics? Is it anything related to all things like collapse, or is it more about something you've said about like the narrative? Yeah, tell me what you think this is about.
Yeah, I think you pretty much summed it up there in the question. You know, to ask the question is to provide the answer. It's about what's going on, and you know, the narrative is a part of what's going on, because it's sort of the official wording of what is going on, right? In the description of the thing that I put in the show notes, I go into why it's called Extinctionati, which is obviously a pun on Extinction Rebellion, you know, that everybody knows about today. And it's kind of a you know, Jem Bendel, who we both know, is a part of it. He was a part of the Extinction Rebellion in the beginning. Now he's doing his own thing. And we had kind of the book club about his book last year. Basically, it's maybe about the climate and the collapse, but also about how to figure out who is talking bullshit. You know, like the official narrative is kind of a bullshit central. They were, in my mind anyway, they were never talking straight about what was going on. I think it was the last episode we delved into whether or not they knew already in 1972 when the climate narrative started at the UN conference in Stockholm, or at least I think it was in the UN system, whether they already knew then that this was going to be ultimately a big deal, but there was nothing we could really do. They still started the narrative and still started telling everybody that this was going to be something that politics would be formed around. But of course, that's nobody says in a text or anything that we are just going to fool you into doing this thing. It's kind of an archaeological task to figure out how much did they know then, and what did they do, and why did they choose to do nothing for 50 years and then do what they do now, right? So, do you have any thoughts about whether we should trust the government?
Well, I think, first of all, I thought I saw someone writing someone in the chat, but I can't find it. So if there's something, where do I find that?
No, I have the chat on my iPad, and it's pretty much just my comments for now.
Okay, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Where is that? Yeah. Wait, close chat. But I just find it strange that I can't find anything. I can't find your what you wrote. There's nothing on the side when I open.
That's on the YouTube.
That's on the YouTube. Okay.
Yeah. It's on the YouTube, this description of the episode.
I'll try to find it, because I would prefer to be able to follow.
Yeah, it's there on my iPad anyway. And it's also the same explanation on the podcast, if you go to about the podcast.
I found it now, and there's only your message in the chat. Okay. Yeah.
We're also trying to get people from the YouTube, watchers of the YouTube, to come onto this show, but that has been so far unsuccessful. But never give up, right?
Yeah. Right. I think there is there's so much said and written about the cynicism and the actions and thoughts of the people in power, how they lie and how they do what they want and say something else and all that. But I suspect that there's also a big, big, big amount of them also just being ordinary. They are just humans. And these scenarios of complications and things that need to be done, and all the lack of all the holes, you know, all the things we don't know about what's the right, what would be the things to do to start to address all the environmental and climate-related problems. It's just so big and complicated that I think that many politicians and many people running businesses and big companies are also like confused, you know. They are also like, where would we, you know, that, and they don't necessarily, well, I understand that the big corporation guys have known what's been going on in research environmentally and regarding climate because they had to know. But in smaller companies and other people in power, I'm sure, and lots of politicians, they are just so not necessarily very intelligent. They are not necessarily good at getting a good overview over something as difficult as those topics. I think there's just a lot of incompetence and people don't know what they're talking about. They don't really know themselves, you know, but... and especially because, yesterday I discovered yet another of these. Do you know Will? What's his name? William Rees, American professor who's been talking a lot about like the whole picture. Do you know his name, William Rees?
He's one of the people I saw in the last week, one of the names I saw.
He's the origin of that footprint. Concept. Yeah, or the word. I've been listening to him a few times, and now yesterday or something, I heard another lecture, maybe an hour long, from another guy who also knew, he said he was a friend of Nate Hagen's, and he had followed him a lot, and he had also a brilliant lecture about this side where you take a step back and you say, he was addressing these four things that we use in our societies, in our industries, which we are so dependent on, you know, steel, fertilizers, concrete, and then there's one more thing I don't remember. Plastic, of course, plastic.
Yeah,
it's like that's us. That's what we do. That's what everything is built from and built of, and so that I don't know at which point in modern late history, the last decades, I don't know when we reached a point where things were starting to become so ingrained in our buildings and roads and hospitals and everything, you know, absolutely everything. I don't know when we reached like the point of no return, but as I see it, this is like, if there aren't any other like cynical reasons for working against, for like helping the earth and helping the climate, and if there wasn't any other reason, this would kind of be reason enough, you know, that we are stuck between a rock and a hard place, as they say, you know. We are it's pest or cholera, some say in Norwegian. So two different diseases or health situations that are hopeless and painful. One is to not do anything about the climate crisis and all the biological and biospherical problems. And the other one is to do something, because the only way to do something is to reduce what we use, and it cannot be done in a systematic, peaceful way. It would be immediately a lot of crashes, you know. So then environmental people will say, and climate and extinction rebellion people, and so they will say, yeah, but if we don't, then we certainly, no, it's not like then we'll certainly, it's super certain that there will be huge crashes if they did something that actually was enough, you know, something that would help. And of course, maybe that would kind of save for those who believe in full extinction. Maybe that would be the difference. We wouldn't go as extinct. I don't have any opinion whether we will go as extinct or not.
Maybe I can start replying before I forget what you said 10 minutes ago.
Yeah.
So yeah. The first thing I would like to say is I totally agree with you when it comes to common regular politicians, you know, the small fries in local assemblies and government or political parties at the national level and stuff. I totally agree that most of them are, if not stupid, then totally unaware about any real aspect of this thing, right? That goes for both eventualities on that this side or that side of the issue, right? So that they're basically what some people have described as followers. You know, they are, you know, often in other contexts, they are often the best conduits for evil, you know, because they don't have any principles, they don't have any kind of will or thinking for themselves in any way. So they just adapt the current thing or the current agenda that is being pushed from people higher up. So I totally agree that they are not themselves or individually responsible for either doing too much or too little or you know, whatever they're doing. Then I would like to insert that from following, because I call myself an expert, not on climate, but on the climate narrative, because I've been following what they said in the news for many, many decades.
Uh-huh.
So from my perspective, it's very, very clear, at least in the Norwegian, Scandinavian context, that they've been saying things within the climate narrative for 50 years, and they've done absolutely nothing, you know, within that, the same frame of reference, right? So if they say this thing is... this series up here, they have done something down there, or even made it worse, you know, from their own narrative, they've done the opposite, right? So if their narrative is that the cars and airplanes do everything bad, then they have released more human carbon pollution after the climate panel was created in 1988. So, and they said that 5 or 10 years ago. So now it's like 75% of all human carbon emissions have been after 1988 and the climate panel, which is amazing. You know, it's a total failure within their own frame of reference. So that is. That is part of why I'm criticizing the narrative, because the narrative seems to be that what we're doing is always right, you know, like any dictator would say, if I'm doing it, it's right and good, right? So the climate narrative has always been about themselves, the leadership, being responsible, we're taking this very serious. And the thing itself being an important thing, of course, is a part of it. But now we see them sort of walking back. Now we see them saying that there is no point of no return. There is no tipping point. And why would they say that, right? They would only say that if they were absolutely sure that we couldn't, that we either pass the tipping points or we couldn't avoid passing them, like in the next year or whatever.
What do you mean when you say now they say that there is no tipping point? What do you mean by that? What are they saying?
They're kind of walking back the tipping point narrative. You know, it's you are familiar with the narrative of Tipping Point. It's like we have to do this in 10 years. If we don't do it in 10 years, it will be too late and run by itself, right? Mm-hmm. So if you look at an article in Salon magazine, for instance, or just different prominent climate scientists within the climate narrative, they have been, what do you call that in English? Pussyfooting or something. They've been, you know, trying to make the tipping point and point of no return thing seem less serious than I would, let's say, okay. 10 years ago.
Have they?
Years ago. Yeah, I noticed because I've been trying to get a straight answer from them for the past 5 years, and they all seem to sort of say, yeah, no, but you know, we could go over it, we could pass the point, and then, you know, really, really take a hard effort and get it down afterwards. But it's kind of, you know, Michael Mann is one of these guys who will block or deplatform everyone who is critical in any way to anything within the climate thing. He's the guy who invented the hockey stick glove, mm-hmm. which is at least famous, maybe infamous. And I read his, you know, his latest book, which is about it's basically written a whole climate book about doomers, how much he hates doomers, you know.
So, oh, really?
But it's all, of course, also about climate change and what he and the government wants to do to save the planet from climate change. And I won't say I read the entire book, but you know, I read the key parts of it. Mm-hmm. And I also did keyword searches for the phrase tipping point, just to see what he was saying about it, you know. And I think maybe he mentions tipping points 30 times, 40 times throughout this book. But it's always about turning the people around and turning the opinions around. So he totally abuses the term. He never talks about climate when it comes to tipping points. So he's made a conscious decision to just kind of spam the term, you know, to just use the term about mobilizing people for climate action to reach a tipping point of opinion.
Ah, the psychological consciousness, like that type of people. Oh, yeah. My God, that's weird.
But he's just one guy, and the other guys are also doing this. So they're also trying to stop using it in terms of climate and CO2 concentration and that kind of thing, and ice cover. Yeah.
And then you said earlier, you said, well, that for you is kind of a almost like a proof that they do believe in those tipping points, or what did you say?
I said that why would they stop talking about it? And I think they stopped talking about it because it's become so clear to them that if there were any tipping points recently, we passed them and they're behind us, and we, you know, so we're in the no return part of the point of no return. it's going to, the way I understand it anyway, it's going to go by its own self amplification, you know, self-reinforcing thing. For instance, you have a classic case of a self-reinforcing feedback loop in the Arctic, because here the methane from the permafrost started coming out when it started to melt or thaw the permafrost. And the more methane it releases because of the melting, the warmer the climate becomes locally, you know, in Siberia and Greenland and Canada and stuff. And then it will become warmer from that and melt more permafrost from that, releasing more methane, right? So at some point on that timeline, the permafrost or the methane doesn't need human beings or cities or cars or airplanes or anything. You know, it just got triggered by whatever happened in the 20th century, you know, in the 1900s. And now it's going berserk in that way. And I also tried to find, because we are very, very close to actually the planet itself, the natural processes being a bigger emitter of all of these things than industry or human activity.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay, talked a lot, so maybe I shut up for a while and you say something.
I've also, okay, how do I frame this or kind of sum it up neatly? I must say that when I was in my 20s, middle of 20s, I was randomly just landing on a subject in university, which was film, like film and TV theory, it was called in Norwegian. It was, yeah, so for 1.5 years, I just read about the history of film and a little bit about television history and a little bit of, yeah, all the developments, and you were watching different movies and watching different scenes and analyzing stuff and learning about everything from art theory to psychology and more like the techniques with lighting. Not that we would learn about how to put lighting for a film, but we were kind of touching upon it, you know, understand the importance of all the elements of a movie scene or a movie in general. All sorts of aspects of movies, living pictures. I don't know, we say that in Norwegian, like moving pictures. And even though I wasn't the most hardworking student, it was a time, it was an experience, those 1.5 years that kind of, it felt as I like exploded inside, you know, of new, like a new dimension or a new world opened up, you know, because what it did more than anything was understanding how narratives and different virkemidler, you know, how different techniques of how to tell a story and how to influence the viewer, and all the details that everything in an image, for example, everything in one scene or just one take in one scene is there for a reason. It's there to create something inside your mind, you know, everything from the music to the light or dark or what kind of, yeah, everything you see has some purpose. And I just understood very quickly and through those months how easily manipulated we are, how little we learn. Mm. That, you know, I remember our professors or whatever they were also saying from the beginning of that it's a kind of a disaster that we don't teach, you know, other people would think of my subject as some luxury thing to do for a Western white person, sit there and study film, you know, oh my God, that's like artistic. But it wasn't at all. It was such important things to learn and understand about our societies, our history, and as I said, influence, manipulation, how the mind works, how we this and that. And I would give everything to remember all those things, you know. I remember almost nothing because there are so many aspects, But I just there back then in 1996, I also did a half year, like 6 months, with another university study that is like the science and philosophy history. Like everybody had to do this subject for 6 months. It's a tradition when you take, when you do this, you have go for a bachelor, which I did. You had to also do those 6 months. So I learned like as much as like the little I was able to take in about history of science and of philosophy. And so that added very much to the, to what I learned in film theory. And and also there were a couple of other subjects I took after that that also very much influenced me. That was literature, actually, and cultural studies. And it changed me forever. And it was like from there, I remember I was thinking, oh, someone should make a big like multimedia presentation to travel around in schools. I don't know which age, ninth grade or videregående, to just demonstrate for them in front of their own eyes how things are built, how the things are done. You know, just they, I'm sure those guys, those young people, they could in 1 hour, 1.5 hours, they could just learn things to change their whole life in the future, how they would view the media, different things coming from media, both the fictional stuff and news and everything. They would understand so much if you gave them the good examples and you show them, you know, don't tell them, just show them, you know, on the screen what's going on. And now, of course, I've been terrified and depressed about how the news media and media in general, how they, what they do, what they don't do, and all that through the years. But through this Ukraine crisis, I didn't pick up on it at all until 2022, like the new situation now with that invasion. That's when I started to pay attention to Ukraine. I didn't know anything about it, really. I just heard the name, something about Crimea. That was about what I knew. I just never followed politics. I didn't hardly know what NATO was at all. I couldn't explain it. So I've learned a lot. And the funny thing is that since I was so neutral from the beginning, I it was very intriguing to me because I tried to find the middle story, like where people could agree on this at least and on this. As soon as I started learning, I was like drawn to one side, like this is the truth and nothing else. And then I tried to, but this isn't that. I tried to ask some questions, you know, some critical questions, which I also, and then it was, then you were almost, after 2 months, I was almost afraid of, like, if someone had, if I was walking out in the streets and people in my town had known what attitudes I had and what questions I had and what I was skeptical about regarding the main narrative about Ukraine, I was starting to be afraid, you know, because it was such a hostile environment. It was like if you question anything or just think one independent thought about these things, people turn towards you and just, who are you? What are you? A Putin lover? Like that immediately, you know, it was so scary. It was so
scary. That reminds me, you know, one of my best friends actually, and he's only doing it for fun, but you know, he regularly calls me an intimate friend of Putin, you know, like doing intimate physical things with him. It hardly goes 1 week before he returns with some kind of insinuation that I'm that close with Putin, even though I haven't left Greenland for the past 4 years. You know, I've been stuck here in Greenland and haven't even been to Siberia, let alone Moscow. You know.
Yeah. So to watch, to just see, watch this play out now, this I've heard, experienced, I'm sure I've heard 7 different very experienced people from the military or from the journalism or from whatever, you know, who have been asked, has the propaganda war, the information war, been worse now? Like, how do you see this information war around Ukraine? Is it worse than things you've been seeing before? Yes, they've never seen as bad as it's been now. How it's been like totally shut down any chance of, you know, and so that has taught me my whole, where I wanted to go with all this, is just that, you know, it has, and when you add AI chaos to this, the next few years when that starts to explode, you know, then it's like, I don't know how anyone, why do people believe that we are able to do anything that will keep us together and help ourselves, you know, when you couldn't even have this, after all, small thing going on in Ukraine without that mayhem of lies and stories that go totally against each other and all that, you know, and how it's not acceptable to actually discuss nuances and the leaders don't even talk on the telephone, you know, they're like 5 years old, they don't, you know, it's, I don't understand how people can have any hope. But to me, at least, the point is, for me, it has been the last confirmation I needed. And I'm scared. I'm really scared, because so far, this is the last thing I say, this far before Ukraine, when I thought about climate, and no, I mean collapse in general, like many others, I think, but I want your opinion on that. My impression is somewhat that climate and in general collapse aware people, it looks to me as they are kind of like keeping this aspect of the element of warfare, they keep it a little bit away. They don't talk so much about that. I have a feeling that they distance themselves, they forget a little bit about it, and they don't want to think about it, or they just maybe even don't even understand. Not that I understand, but I've come to think of it more and more the last months and the last year, that shit, before anything climate related will take us, there will of course be terrible wars, you know, the war will be the biggest problem now in our lifetime, somewhat.
Maybe I can start, not sure if you finished, but maybe I can start answering that while I'm still remembering the big points.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm thinking, I can't answer for everybody, of course, but if you ask me personally, I will say that, or me wearing my thinking hat, you know, as a thinker, if I may have shut out the Ukraine, Crimea River story, and even Gaza and the new shenanigans done in the Middle East, I would say yes, I have been trying to shut it out. I've been trying to watch some volcano developments in Iceland, all kinds of tricks to shut out the really, really horrible stuff going on. But there is another side to it, which is that, you said that you needed that, or that was sort of the last piece that you needed in order to complete your picture of how screwed up things were, right? So for me, anyway, it's like I already knew that, you know, I already knew how fake any war, or how fake any propaganda about the war is. Those are things that I know, I think, at least most of it. And you know, I don't want to come across as boasting about, you know, I've been there before you, blah, blah, blah. That's not what I'm trying to do. But I do. You know, even though people can accuse me of blanking out the Ukraine war and the Gaza war, I'm not. But I think it's very important to have a panoramic view of the world. You know, even if you're just going to talk about ecology, climate, and collapse stuff, you need a panoramic view. We had a pandemic, which was, you know, what should you even say about it? I don't care what I can say about it for the authorities. I don't care. But how are you even going to summarize that? You know, and just every single war for the last 20 years, at least, is just totally made up by narratives, as you say, narratives that are not even half waterproof. You know, you can just start looking at it or buying the book from the most investigative journalists and authors, and it all falls apart. You know, it's, there wouldn't be any war at all if they had to act on actual proof, and they had to, you know, prove it in a court of law or you know, in an investigation before bombing the shit out of that country, right? That kind of thing. So I think we all, and I also have a tendency to sort of to watch a narrow part of the policy field and sort of shut out the other things.
I have to insert here because I hear, I can hear that you kind of, I didn't explain well either, so you misunderstood a little bit exactly what I meant. Yeah. And maybe you can say the same thing afterwards that you want to say now. But the thing is that when I said that people don't, that they shut it out, I didn't mean that they should be like following and be engaged in the wars now. I meant more that I have a feeling that people are expecting the natural processes with climate, especially, to become the horrible, terrible problem, to become what we're going to suffer from. But I have this feeling that I think the wars are going to fuck us before we feel, you know. And it, I don't hear a lot about that, you know. People don't mention that so much.
That's an interesting difference of opinion. I would actually take the opposite on that, because you know, there's two sides to everything being fake in a war, right? So the one thing is that we would never get to hear the balanced summary of what went on. You know, it's always this side or this side, right? But the other side of it, with everything being fake and the motivation for doing it being fake and the reluctance to take the telephone and talk to Moscow being fake, everything is fake. That also means that you can, you know, tomorrow is Monday. They could end the war tomorrow, on Monday. Just take a few phones, send a few telefaxes or whatever it's called. Donald Trump has even said that if he became president, he would end the war in 2 days, right?
Which is true, but okay. It's not that easy. But well, as you say,
it's possible, yeah.
Yeah, if he had the mandate, if he had all that power, but he wouldn't have all that power, I think. But
so the big difference is if you think about the whole upper part of Siberia as one big bleeding corpse, like a whale bleeding from its skin or whatever, a big beached whale, but only it's the permafrost, it's the ground, and it's leaking methane gas, you know. There's no telephone in the world you can dial and stop that kind of thing. You know, it's a natural process. You understand what I'm saying? So it's my view anyway. It's a totally opposite of the fear that you talked about, that the wars would spin out of control. They are super controlled. Control is all they are about. I'm totally open for you to convince me the other way. I'm just saying this is my view, and of course it looks worse and people are dying in numbers more obviously from the wars because they are immediate. But I think in terms of being able to be stopped, which is an interesting topic in itself.
Absolutely, you know, I agree with you there.
What can we stop? What can we not stop? Yeah,
That's for sure.
So I thank you for bringing up that kind of thing, because which things can we stop and which can we not stop is kind of the core of these conversations.
True. Yeah, I get it. And I certainly would agree that in the long term, the wars are nothing, you know, because what nature, when that is collapsing, that's, we cannot do anything, like you say, or yeah, and it will be total. But what I'm feeling is that when, as soon as the climate, if the climate impact, the warming, heating impact and stuff, not just heating, but weather changes and stuff, if they actually get as bad as this that people assume now, as soon as it starts to really, really hurt, you know, and as soon as people start to flee from countries and don't have water and they don't have this and that, then the war starts, you know. So it's kind of like, at least like, especially for a country like, or like Northern Europe, you know, I have the terrible fear that the military attacks and military situations will be felt for me personally.
Okay.
Before I will feel the real like direct impact from natural disasters and stuff, but I don't know. Of course, I'm so afraid of war, you know, because let me say that what I've had this thought for many, many years now, that if I were to answer the question, what is the worst thing I can imagine in the world, you know, what's the worst thing that could happen in the world then, or that is going on in the world, then it's kind of like the art of, or the use of torture, like people in power, especially in war situations, I guess, but also outside of it. You know, if you're stuck in a natural disaster, in a earthquake or anything really, that when that happens to you, of course it's horrific, painful, terrifying, but nothing is as terrifying as another human being.
Yeah, I agree.
Dying, pain and horror to you, and by they decide to do it, and they stand there in front of you. You know, that's like
that was part of the reason why there was, you know, in 2021 there was this coming together of people from all over the world who were watching these new eruptions on Iceland and talking in chat with each other. One of the reasons that was such a great positive experience was that we were coming out of a pandemic, or we were in the middle of a pandemic, which was so horrible, and even rumors left and right about it being created by some evil scientists, right, and releasing it. And also, you know, in the contrast to wars with torture, and exactly what you said, that there was this catastrophe, which was natural, and it even chose to happen in a faraway, remote valley on top of a mountain or something. You know, nobody got hurt. You know, it's just great fun to be had by all, and tourists flying there and walking up to the volcano. Yeah, so that was kind of a, you know, happy natural disaster. And it was, everybody had been locked down for a year or so, and it was just, people wanted to talk to other people and needed to talk to other people, and this was totally undramatic or non-dangerous because, no evil power or east or west or whatever it was behind the lava coming out, you know, it was just the nature.
I also remember someone who taught me about like trauma, PTSD, no, what do you call it? PTSD and stuff like that.
PTSD.
Yeah, when people are really traumatized by really big concrete things, you know, like a natural disaster, for example, from the tsunami, when that famous tsunami happened. So people have trauma issues later. Then someone was showing me like this layer thing where what is the most difficult trauma to kind of treat and to release and to get well again, you know, from the, and then you would have like natural disasters on the what do you say, like on the top, or but on the bottom, you know, the least terrible thing for someone to go through was natural disasters, and then in the middle, the worst, the absolute worst or most complicated traumas would be from humans abusing you sexually and stuff, you know. And in like the top terrible thing was like your close relative, like your family, your parents or someone doing it, you know. The closer the person is, the harder the trauma is, you know. And then you have like out there nature disasters, because it's impersonal. Nobody did it to you. Yeah. It was nobody's fault, all that. So, yeah, it's the same thing.
Yeah, it's, it, you know, it borders on some, I won't call them philosophical works, just you know, some short writings that I put up in the previous installment of Extinction Mountain. No, that was in the number two installment. But it's just about, you know, if we look at some of the predictions for the future coming all the way from 1970s, you know, with the Clever Rome and them saying we are going into an overshoot and resources, food and everything coming to a close at around this time in the 2020s. So in that kind of collapse scenario that everybody talks about, right? Just some people are crazy and say it happens in 2025. It doesn't happen in 2025. It happens, you know, further down the line somewhere. Then you have... you know, at least as a thought experiment or a philosophy, you have two different years or dates, right? So let's say in 2030, global industry collapses, and you compare that to 2070, for instance. So you have a 40-year gap. Everything collapses in 30 or in 70. Then, as a deep ecologer, you could argue that the best date of those two for the total collapse of the human civilization would be the 2030s, because then every other part of the biosphere, you know, the plants and trees and animals and fish and birds and everything, would have a much better chance at surviving and going on compared to things collapsing in the 2070s. And even for human beings, it would be better that nature had a good chance of carrying on, like with the 2030 narrative. Because where are you going to shop your groceries after everything closes down? You have to go into the forest and pick some berries or whatever, right? So even for human beings, which are kind of the bad guy in this story, it would be better if it all collapsed in 2030 compared to 2070. Yeah. So, And I remember I expected to get so much pushback for that short text about these things. And then, of course, the real life, you know, reality bites, and nobody cares. Absolutely nobody cares. I was sort of expecting to go to jail for having philosophized about two different collapse timelines.
Where you published this?
I put it on YouTube, so it's on this channel. It's called something like Midsummer Deep Ecology. It would be from 2022, I think it would be 22. Yeah. So just a search for Midsummer in one word and the deep ecology in two words. It was a dog. I thought I heard a dog.
Oh yeah.
I wasn't sure if it was a dog or a sleeping spouse or something.
Snoring sounds.
Snorting sounds.
Yeah. Your microphone. Okay. Yeah, how long do you usually go? Is it for 1 hour or?
I haven't followed the clock. So, okay. So now the climate chat is on. The live show called Climate Chat. It starts right now, so maybe we should make it a short one.
What's that?
No, it's just another YouTube show with the live audience. But it's, you know, if you want to go on, you can go on for it.
Oh no, nothing burning, so I can easily save things. But
I thought the dog was sort of a cue for me to, yeah, he needs to go for a walk or something.
Oh yeah, no, of course she would always want that. She doesn't understand why we are sitting inside the house. But
oh god, no, I'm in deep trouble. I misgendered a dog on YouTube. I'm going to get my channel deleted.
Yep, you're going to be cancelled. Yep.
It looks like, you know, the head looked like a he, but you know, what do I know about dogs? I'm sorry YouTube, sorry Google, I'm sorry Zio. I should say they is maybe better.
Yeah.
you were starting to say something, sorry?
No, I just was curious what you meant. You have to repeat it again. You said the climate chat is starting now, and you didn't explain yourself well, very well. What did you mean?
Climate. Oh, no, it's just a channel called Climate Chat, and they have shows every Sunday. So.
Okay, yeah, but you go for that. I'm good now. It's good.
No, I can go back. I can go back to it. I can rewind it. It's okay. But what do you think? What do you think would be an interesting topic for next week, if you had to choose?
No, I have one on my mind, but it's not something that could be like a main theme. It's just one thing that would probably go be quite quickly finished. So I can't really think about something else, and I can't promise to come up with any suggestions either. But if I do, I can write it in the chat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, super. And then... I will just repeat what I said initially, that we want other people to, you know, find their way out of the YouTube chat and click the link and come on the conferencing video thing, you know, where me and Zio is, and talk to us. And if you don't want to show your beautiful face, you can actually just mute your video, like I'm doing or attempting to do now. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you can just be some logo or some initials or something. So you don't have to sort of dress up just to be on with us. You can just talk. talk with us, or you can just come on and listen for an hour and then talk, like I used to do, you know, 3 years ago. I would never say anything, but maybe say something in the third hour of the show or something. So it's all acceptable. It's just a fun way to, you know, have your say and chime in with your opinion to whatever the conversation is going on about.
Sounds good.
And with that, I think we should all go to the climate chat. I'll send you a link to the show in the chat of this video.
Yeah, thank you.
Check it out. Okay. Have a nice next week to you and to everyone watching. And again, I'm very sorry to the dog for misgendering her.
Thank what? You. Sorry for
misgendering your sweet female dog.
Yeah, I'm a bit upset still, but I'll get over it.
Yeah, it wasn't intentional. Okay.